Well, good morning. A tip of the hat to all of you stalwart people that have either had planes canceled on you or you're just that tenacious that you haven't given up yet. My brain's oozed out of my ears yesterday, and so enough is enough. But a little bit more. I want to take this conversation in a little bit different direction, and it's part discussion of potential valuable methodology, perhaps, and it's part a bigger picture about understanding the systems in which we operate. And I think, especially in terms, in the world of long-term studies, it is so critical to have sites that are predicated upon representation of significant areas rather than just convenience of logistics and availability. We deal in an imperfect world, and we can't always choose what we have to work with as resources, but I would like to suggest that when it's possible, A, understand your systems well, and I think Craig's talk demonstrated that quite well, and B, give some thought to the underpinning architecture of these sites and what that implies in terms of understanding the dynamics that we monitor and articulate. So I'd like to pose to you several points, and then hopefully show them to you. Number one is that I think soil systems, or we believe that soil systems, provide a critical link between soil point data and ecosystem processes of areas across multiple scales. Secondly, that the soil systems constitute a quantifiable framework that explains soil distributions and processes that underpin spatial models. Or to put it another way, models have greater utility, and I think scalar reliability when stratified by a soil landscape system. Third, it integrates hydropodology into these explorations to explain both soil distribution and function or processes. Water is the lifeblood of the earth. Where the water goes, certain things are carried with and away, and other things are left behind. And if we trace the water, we understand the systems. Oftentimes, that dynamic has not been adequately captured in understanding or trying to understand ecosystems and their function. And finally, just a general statement that soil systems really do provide a conceptual model that's very effective in communicating soil knowledge and ecosystem knowledge across scientific disciplines and very diverse audiences. Put this information in a format that people can understand, because we are not the sole users of it. Okay, so, case in point. What do you see? Yeah, you see some white stuff? When I look at this, and the point of this is to say, this is what the kind of thing that most people imagine when we think about soils. You're seeing a multi-layered system. There's some dominant strata. Obviously, they must have some different contrasting properties. You see some microvariability in it, yes? But it's more or less the same across that view. And this is a standard 2 meter deep zone within which most of us would do our sample acquisition and our data collection. That's what we quantify when we talk about soils. Good stuff, useful stuff. That little red box is over here in the right-hand corner over here a little bit. That's the same place. And I would say, what do you see? Well, we see some differences, yeah? There's spatial variability here. And if you track that white zone, which is calcium carbonate enriched zone. You track that calcium carbonate horizon, clearly it's not continuous. It's not uniform across that zone. Well, now what? We've had that point that we just said that the data we collect and we articulate really is just a pet on or a point. How do we get credibly from that to this? Well, landscapes and ecosystems contain spatial variability, and they both have random and non-random complexity in that variability. Okay, so in this one map unit, there's some identifiable variability. What can we do about it? Do we throw up our hands and say, no, we're stuck, we're sunk, we can't articulate it, we don't know what to do with it, it's too complex? No, we can't do much about the random variability. We just simply don't understand at this point. But there is a strong dimension of non-random complexity that we can identify, we can explain, and we can predict if we understand the system we're in. So in this case, the calcium carbonate horizon varies in several predictable ways, and we can see them. First of all, it's thickest along the edge-focused evaporative discharge. There's a bathtub ring around this image. Starts on this side and goes around and comes back up over here. And that's where the thickest calcium carbonate exists. If you go out into the center of this low area, it's either thin or absent. And if you go outside it, you go on the uphill side, it disappears as you move up into the side slopes because of erosion and different hydrology conditions. But the point is that there is complexity in here that is non-random, and if you understand your system, you can explain it and put it to use. You can do it either collectively or explain content within a map unit that you have. So soil surveys are built upon pedons and map units, and the good ones are based upon soil landscape models. The pedon data represents properties at a single point along a catenary gradient or along a continuum. That's often the reality we face. So it makes a difference where you poke your hole and gather your samples. If they're not representative, you're going to have problems. If you understand the system, you increase the probability that you're going to get representative samples and good things happen. So, catenas represent areas, or can be used to that effect. They include soilscape water movement, internal water movement. And it addresses and incorporates both toposequence and hydrosequences at the same time. So what? Well, it matters because it explains how soil bodies and processes relate to their neighbors. You're not talking about isolated point data any longer. We're now talking about relationships between soil bodies. Soil systems are collections of dominant, recurring catenas. And the use of them can help link soil processes and properties. Here's some really an example of some good pioneering work that was done out of North Carolina by Ray Daniels and Joe Kleiss and Stan Buell some years ago. And they took the perspective that you could take an area, and in this case it's a state, but you could, it could be an MLRA, it could be an ecoregion, it could be whatever area you wish to attack, and parse it out into physiographic subsets. And in this case, they found three. They had the Appalachian Mountains, the Piedmont, and the Coastal Plain. And then within each of those physiographic areas, they were able to subdivide it into catenas, dominant catenas that explained and covered about 80 or 90% of those different systems, those physiographic areas. In this case, there were as few as three in the mountains and up to nine down in the coastal plain. Point is that you can identify major catenas, you can talk about it, you can explain it in some essential graphics, and you can map it. So I would take a little short trip out here to the coastal plain. Not all of you have ever been to the lower coastal plain in the Atlantic seaboard, and the mosquitoes miss you. But here's an example of what they were able to do with that approach. They started out and they wanted to give a condensed portrayal of what this ecosystem is, this particular catena is. So they, first of all, they developed a sketch and they included scales so that you can tell that the vertical and the horizontal context of what you're looking at. And you'll note that the vertical scale is just several meters and the lateral kilometers. But you're looking at a very flat terrain. Yet there are topographic micro differences that can be tracked and identified and conveyed. They threw in some geomorphic information, they threw in some soils information, different soil types, they threw in some stratigraphic information about the parent materials, and they even included some iconic vegetation information so that you can begin to get a flavor of the vegetative component of the ecosystems, of what dominates or what's iconic. Okay, let's go to something, and this is clearly not the lower coastal plain. Let's look somewhere else and see what we see. What do you see? Well, we see some changes, we see some patterns. What do we see? We pick up some information parsed out and subdivided into meaningful units. You can add in soils. Here's a major catena. This is in South Dakota. And clearly there's differences between this Cedar Pass unit here, which is deep alluvium and its properties, versus this Kyle unit, which is composed of slope alluvium or hill slope sediments coming down from above, and the shallower soils further upslope. The point is that you can take a system and you can break it down into meaningful units that you can use, develop from a catenary context. You can use that information then, point data, to extrapolate across that area, across that watershed, across that ecosystem, to articulate the morphometric placement of that, and to extrapolate the soil properties that are associated with it. Okay, here's another setting. This is in Kentucky. Classical approach of soils investigation. We're looking at different soil types and different hill slope positions in a forested system. And you're seeing some typical soil point information, right? We've got PEDON data. You've got soil horizonation, a little bit of texture information, stratigraphic sequencing, and that's it. And that's the typical information upon which many investigations are conducted and underpin our understanding. But can we do better? And the answer is sure we can. If you take an approach where you can begin to connect the dots, you can develop the pedostratigraphy of this system, which is done here, stylized, but there. And then we can use that to drape, upon which to drape quantitative data. So in this case, we're going to look at hydraulic conductivity, saturated hydraulic conductivity. We're looking at average values at these different layers in each of these positions. So we can use this as an architecture upon which to drape quantified data. What do we see? We see a couple of things. One of them is that these numbers decrease with depth, and that's true in all the positions. But we can do one better than that. Because we have these spatial relationships and the sequencing down from high ground to low ground, we can interpret that quantitative data into how water is moving through that system. And you can see, even though these numbers are decreasing with depth up here in the summit, there's still quite a bit of flow at depth, which is to say that there's vertical recharge of the groundwater system at that site in those positions. It's also true to a degree in the shoulder. But as you come down to the back slope and to the foot slope, the same vertical decrease is true. But when you get down to the lower units, you're hitting almost no flow at all. So the interpretation of that is that you're getting quite a bit of vertical recharge in the upper part of this landscape, but as you come down on the side slopes, you're changing over to through flow or lateral flow, and there you're getting discharge in the lower part of the unit. And you can see which parts of the system are conducting lateral flow or vertical flow. So it's a tool. And here's some work that's been done by Toby Ajean out in the Sierra Nevada foothills, and he looked at a watershed, and using lysimeters, they were able to parse out by horizonation the water flow yield, lateral water flow yield, to the stream flow hydrograph that you see up above, and parse it out into the respective horizons and zones through which that's conducted. And you can see here that 60% of the water flow that's going to that stream flow response is coming through the AB horizon. Now you have a mechanism to tie the water flow quantity through which zone it's passing. You have a statement of residence time between those different layers. You have access to the idea that the properties of what can be retained and what can be yielded from each of those major horizons is relevant to the stream flow output. They did that by looking at the dissolved organic carbon content and the concentration of the water flow. They also did it with looking at the nitrate-nitrogen load that was coming off of that system, and it could tie it back to the where in the landscape and what zones within the landscape, which horizons. Now we're off to the races. So, something more about climate change, because that was part of what we're talking about, is changing of systems and ecosystems. You can take this approach and you can look at it in a three-dimensional context, and here we've got a nice, crudely drawn, hand-drawn block diagram. We've got recharge zones, different moisture zones that conceptually integrate geomorphology, pedology, stratigraphy, hydropedology, and climate. And this is the wet season. If you look at the partial contributing area down here, what happens when we get into the dry season? It's quite different. So now we have changes that are seasonally controlled. You can take that awareness and that application on a continental scale and look at humid environments versus subhumid and semi-arid and note that you have different areas that are recharged. Here, the upland and humid environment, the recharge is up high. In semi-arid environment, classic hydrogeology, the recharge areas in the low areas. Take this, and you can do it both regionally, but you can also do it seasonally or the sort of pluvial or dry cycles that we occur. If you're in a drought cycle in South Carolina, in the sand hills, that system may change from a humid environment hydropedology dynamic to a subhuman if you go through a drought cycle. We can apply these principles to look at climate change in many different ways. So in conclusion, I think soil systems do provide an architecture for underpinning long-term study sites. They provide a critical link between point data and ecosystem areas and processes. It provides a quantifiable framework, integrates hydropedology, and it provides a conceptual model for communication. A couple of last thoughts. This is just for fun. Here's an example in the Central High Plains. You have a closed depression. We're looking at loss over the Ogallala Aquifer. We're going to follow this progression of soils here in a minute, but I want to look at this little spot right here. We've dug a pit here. What do you see? You see some kind of a whiter area down here. You see a well-structured gray zone here. And there's something going on up high. So let's look at that a little closer. Turns out that this is a carbonate concentration, calcium carbonate concentration. But up above, these little white threads, there's no carbonate in it. It's gypsum. So what? What do you care? You can read this morphology because we know that the calcium carbonate solubility is less than that of gypsum. The water that's transporting that, the water, the lifeblood of the earth, is moving, has to be moving up at that site from the bottom to the top. It tells us so. If you step back and look at that sequence, what do you see? We were right here. The upper part of the profile sequence here, or the catena sequence, you start out with carbonates at depth. They come up closer to the surface along the edge. But by the time you reach this edge-focused evaporative discharge zone, water's coming up. If you go out to the center of that low area, there's a thick argillic, there are no salts, there's no carbonates, there's no gypsum. Water has to be moving down. We can use the morphology to read and recreate the water dynamics of these systems if you understand the catenary sequence. Useful tools, interesting stuff. Any questions?